Welcome to the after party. It's time to change. You're just getting started. You can teach an old dog new ways, and not just on Saturday.
Hey, this is Anna David. You are listening to After Party Pod, a podcast about addiction and recovery. And today, a podcast about two old friends catching up. When I say old, I am not referring to our age. I am referring to the length of time we have known each other. And the cool thing about this episode is that this is somebody I met when she was brand new into sobriety. So I've kind of been able to follow her journey, although she and I had not seen each other in 6 years when we recorded this. Anyway, you know her, you love her. You're probably, a lot of you are here just because you follow her. She's got a bit of a rabid following. Her name is Emily McCombs. She's a writer, a blogger. She had a podcast for a while. She's a multimedia queen of all media. Sorry, Howard Stern. She's also a mom and the adopted mom of the cat that looks like Adam Driver, something you should go Google immediately because the resemblance is uncanny. And Emily has written a bunch of stories that have gone, as they say, viral, including her best known and the one that really put her on the map, which was about how her rapist friended her on Facebook, got her on Dr. Phil, a lot of other places. She writes very openly, not just about her addiction and recovery and sobriety, but about sex addiction. And in particular, meeting guys on Craigslist and being unable to give that up even when sober from drugs and alcohol. So we get into that in depth in this episode. By the way, if you don't listen to my other podcast, it's called You've Got Issues with Anna David. And you should go listen to that now because it is great. It is a bit of, I started it because I started to hear from people who like this podcast who aren't sober, who aren't even that interested in addiction and recovery. And I thought, let's do something for them. And it's been really, really fun. Enough about that. I'm going to give you Emily McCombs.
I first started taking drugs by chewing blocks of hash.
Oh my God. I think my copy has like blood stains on it from shooting up while reading it.
Party animal. I hate to say that because that makes me sound Paris Hilton-y. I was on the, as right. I call it, the Autobahn to nowhere.
I'm very lucky because would you have wanted to have a celebrity junkie for a dad?
I would say that we're already going. Okay. Because we figure out the specific aspects as we go.
Right. Okay.
So.
About how much my life sucks in sobriety.
Okay. But we're going to talk about the highs and the lows.
Okay.
Because that's the reality of life and sobriety.
Okay.
So, because I'm, you know, narcissistic, I kind of start usually with like, how did like we met? Because we met when you were like a day sober.
Like days. I don't remember how, like 11, I think, or something
is
like
that. Is that true?
Like 11 days, and it was my first, this seems crazy now that it was 11 days in, and I was like, my first party with alcohol.
Right,
but like,
right.
It was a networking event.
Yeah.
And I wanted to go because I wanted to
network.
Yeah. But I had not been anywhere where there was going to be alcohol since I had started counting days. And so
right.
I was really scared. And also because it's not the kind of thing where you go with like a friend. So it's like
you couldn't bring anybody.
Right. You're like walking into a room where you know no one and where people are drinking.
Yeah, it's true. And it was, I would say, almost an emphasis on booze. Just like a lot of things.
Well, I did get a Diet Coke, but I had to ask for it.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
someone
yeah.
had to like go find it.
That's right. They didn't have anything. Yeah. The assumption was that.
Wasn't even like juice, I don't think.
No,
there weren't like mixers.
It was like a thing in an office. Remember, it was someone's office.
There was like wine
yeah.
and like maybe some hard liquor, but I don't remember mixers.
No. I think so. It was a thing. So I had moved to New York. I was very new in town. And there was like this club, I don't know, a thing where they would invite 8 people.
It was very secret and exclusive.
And they were like, you can't tweet about it, yet there were articles in the New York Times about it. Do you remember? so it was like they'd invite 10 people or something, and you'd give a speech about what you did for a living.
Yeah, and I did like nothing cool, so I felt like a loser because like the guy who created Tumblr was
there. That's right.
I'm probably not supposed to say that, but I feel like the statute of limitations has passed.
This was like a really long time ago.
Yeah,
but I met people who ended up like being in my life. Like I ended up meeting Sherry Goldhagen, who became a really good friend.
I've met her at those. I went back to the reunions.
Me too, and they were super fun.
A really good time and met a lot of cool people. Yeah.
So yeah, it was a good thing. So we met and you were like, I'm 11 days sober. And had you read Party Girl?
I had read Party Girl. Yeah. So I had an idea that you were sober.
Right.
I don't remember if I knew for sure because Party Girl is like fictionalized.
Yeah. Allegedly. No. So yes. And so then we started hanging out.
And we started talking about addiction memoirs.
Like
which ones were good and which ones sucked at the party.
And I said Permanent Midnight. I'm sure that's what I said.
But you weren't, there was one that you weren't into because you said it was down on AA. And I can't remember which one it was, but it was one I liked.
I think it was more that it exposed so much of AA.
It was dry.
Right.
It wasn't anonymous enough.
You talked about specific meetings.
Yeah, well, dry. So. I mean, August Ambrose has gone on to super trash AA in his later.
Oh, I never.
Stuff, because he's not in it anymore. And now everything he writes,
he
writes like about how shitty AA is. Great. And how it. And I love August Ambrose, but every time I'm like, oh, do we have to do this? Like,
I know.
Because I don't think everybody has to do AA.
No.
I just think why close that door for somebody that it might help?
It is really unfortunate. And I deal with this like all the time. And I do my best to not talk specifically about it. But sometimes in defense of it.
Am I not supposed to be talking about
AA
right now?
No, you're supposed to talk about whatever you want. One of my writers, and I'm going to admit this, for some reason I'm embarrassed. I got an email, as did one of my writers, from AA. That said, it's a weird email. It basically says, thank you so much for spreading positivity. Now please stop talking about it.
What? Wait, from AA?
Yeah.
Oh, wait, no, I got one too.
Oh, you did?
But it was like a form letter, mine.
Yeah.
It wasn't like,
My writer is super offended and freaked out and wrote in a brilliant piece that's running on the site about it.
I got one like a few years ago.
Yeah, me too. This is my second. And I
generally don't say AA, like in things that I write. I say meetings. I say like 12-step or recovery circles.
But
everybody knows what you mean.
I know.
So it's sort of this silly, like, it's kind of like Craigslist where if you say like roses, they don't know you mean dollars.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Oh, that's like the Craigslist, like the like casual encounters. Or the,
you say I like roses?
No. Like you would say like 300 roses for, you know, you to come over. And it means dollars, but people think it's like, oh, the cops can't get you because you said roses.
Oh, my God. The things I don't know.
Well, let me tell you, girl.
I know.
About Craigslist acronyms. And so, they have them for all the drugs, too. I mean, you say if you wanted to do cocaine, which back when I did cocaine, sometimes I would go on Craigslist and I would just find like a guy who was doing cocaine and wanted a girl to come over.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say they were ski instructors looking for snow bunnies.
Oh, yeah. That's so obvious.
Yeah.
So
okay. I was a snow bunny.
So let's talk about that. So you one day get this idea. So you're doing, what were your like main things? With cocaine, but mostly drinking.
It was cocaine and drinking.
Yeah.
And then I quit cocaine and I kept drinking and the drinking got worse.
Yeah. That's a bad plan.
I think discovered that the cocaine meant I could keep drinking without blacking out or like falling asleep or passing out.
Yeah, that wasn't my thing.
I just
loved cocaine. And then like drinking would help me come down.
Yeah. No, I like to do, well, for me, it was a trifecta. I liked to have, I needed to have alcohol, cocaine, and then I needed to find a stranger to have sex with.
Right.
So it was like all three of those things were part of my ideal evening.
But didn't cocaine diminish the desire to have sex with a stranger?
No. I mean, it made me really weird and pervy and...
So you sure you weren't doing meth accidentally?
No. Sometimes the guys couldn't get it up because they were on cocaine.
Yeah.
But for me, like people like watch porn on cocaine? Like,
I know, but I think that's because like they lose the ability, this is not scientifically proven, to like talk to other humans, which is what used to happen.
No, it's true. I have seen guys go into like a weird porn hole like on cocaine
where it's like they're watching it like
an HBO drama.
Right.
But for me, like, I had lots of like weird, uninhibited, like porn-like sex on cocaine.
So the first time you did that, was that surreal or just felt right or natural?
I mean, this all goes like way back. I think like the sex and the substances being like tied up together.
Right.
And I struggled with the sex stuff like long into sobriety.
Right.
Too.
Right.
Like, it took a long time. I had to do a lot of work.
And you've written sort extensively about it.
Yeah, I've written about it a little bit. I mean, it's pretty graphic. So sometimes I feel a little bit like, oh, my son might read this someday. But
right.
But then I don't think I have anything to be ashamed of. I mean, you know, that's sort of with all this stuff, we do shameful things, but those are the coping mechanisms that we had, the tools that we had at our disposal at the time.
Yeah.
And then luckily we got new tools.
Yeah.
So I try to just look at it like that, as I just literally didn't have any other tools.
So how long into sobriety did that last, and what did you do to change it?
I would say it took me 4 or 5 years of acting out sexually in sobriety. And so that was sex for money. That was casual encounters, you know, anonymous guides from Craigslist, and really extreme, like sometimes 3 in 1 day, you know.
Wow.
Like, I'm working a job and I'm going to go like meet a guy in the morning and have sex with him. And I'm going to go meet a guy at a hotel on my lunch break. And then after work, before I go home, I'm going to meet a guy.
Right.
And
right.
have sex with him. It was just like it's just like drinking. There was never enough, you know,
right.
Because
right.
it only worked for a little while, like for whatever it was doing for me.
Right.
Giving me self-esteem, making me feel validated. And
that was,
you know,
what it was. Is that
the
whole thing?
I mean, I knew intellectually that like getting a dude to sleep with you is not an
hard.
Accomplishment.
No.
But I think, yeah, with the low self-esteem thing, it was like, and then also it was like adrenaline, like fear, like putting myself in a dangerous situation, self-destructive, you know.
Right. And you were open about it. You lived with your boyfriend.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't know all that at the time.
He didn't know, but then you wrote about it later.
Well, yeah, he doesn't.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
He doesn't know the full extent of it unless he listens to this.
Yeah.
But he definitely found out, you know, some things that I had done. Yeah. So I started going to a therapist who specialized in sex addiction. And I called this guy in like the middle of the night because I couldn't talk to somebody. Like, I knew I had to just leave the voicemail in the moment when I had that like momentary gift of desperation. That was like, okay, I've got to call right now because tomorrow morning I'll think this is fine.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So I called this guy who was like the sex addiction guy in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I left what must have been the most sad, desperate sounding email on his, voicemail.
He's heard him.
But he still, like, he talked about it. Like, the whole, he was like, I still remember that voicemail.
Wow. Like, just once, you mean, or?
Yeah. No, he talked about it a few times. But
no, that you left a desperate email.
Yes,
message once.
I left that desperate voicemail, and it was like, I think I'm going to die. Like, you know, I feel like if I don't stop this, I'm going to die. Because it was really just the level of danger, you know, of meeting strange men.
In their apartments.
It was like, I'm either going to get an STD that's going to kill me, you know, I'm going to get murdered and stuffed in a dumpster,
right?
You know, or I'm going to kill myself because I'm so miserable.
Right.
So, you know, I left that and he called me back and I started seeing this guy, and then he had a group. So I started going to group for sex addiction. And then I started going to one of the fellowships for sex addiction. Well, a few of them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the thing that was weird about all of that, which I'm actually writing about right now for Vice, is it's all men. You know, you're surrounded by
a lot
by
of
men.
Gay men, too.
Well, it's one of the fellowships, which is where I eventually ended up, is primarily gay men. Mm-hmm. And that was a much more comfortable environment for me. But the rest of them are mostly straight guys.
It is very strange that is not more divided into the gender specific.
Well, the thing is, generally in New York, at least in the meetings I've been to, like, you know, the women tend to be love addicts,
right,
and the men tend to be sex addicts.
Right.
So when there's a woman, and it certainly happens, when there's a woman who's a straight sex addict, who's like, I can't stop having sex with strangers, not like I'm texting my ex or I'm, you know,
obsessing
fantasizing.
Over,
then you feel really, really alienated from like the love addiction stuff.
Yeah. And you don't think there's any of the love addiction stuff
in
your story?
Oh, no, there totally is. But it's like, I was life and death. Like, I was like, right. I can't stop having sex for money with strange men. Right. And I'm afraid I'm going to get murdered. Right. And somebody's like, I've got 3 days off texting my ex. Right, you know, and right, I know it's just as painful. It's just as valid.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in the moment, that wasn't helpful for me. And so, yeah, I was more like a gay man.
Right,
in
right. A gay man in a woman's body. We haven't heard that.
Well, it's the reason you're like a gay man is because, you know, the men, the straight men who are sex addicts, they can't get sex as easily as a woman can.
Right,
you know,
right,
like gay men can have sex whenever they want, as can women.
Right, right, right. So it's more porn
it was
and prostitutes
for the men. Yeah, there's porn
the
and prostitutes, massage parlors, you know, a lot of like cheating on their wives, but it's not like it's they can't go on Craigslist and have sex with three women a day the way I was able to find three guys a day, you know?
And all, the combination of all of this sort of got you into recovery from it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was terrible. And obviously, like, I was sober from drugs and alcohol. I was working a program, so it didn't feel good. Like, I knew what I was doing was wrong because I was in a relationship, you know? And I knew what I was – I knew
– It was hurting you.
It was hurtful. You know, it was that place I was there with alcohol, too, where you know you have a problem but you can't fix it yet.
Yep.
And you're just in that painful place of, like, watching yourself make the same mistakes over and over and over again and knowing it's not going to work but doing it anyway.
Well, and I don't know if it was, like, what it was like for me with alcoholism and addiction, it was I can't stop.
Right.
Like, really.
Yeah, I couldn't.
But just like believing it was never going to be possible.
I never thought it was going to be possible.
Right.
I mean, even once I was in recovery, even once I got some like sexual sobriety under my belt, I never thought those compulsions were going to go away.
Right.
Like, I thought that I was going to want to act out in that way for the rest of my life. Because it's really deep. It's really old, the sex stuff. Like, it goes way, way back before alcohol for me.
Right.
You know, because it's about, like, trauma and childhood shit.
Right.
And it felt so strong and so deeply rooted in there.
Yeah.
But then the crazy, like, amazing, the cremazing thing has been that.
Go copyright that.
Yeah. I think someone said that before. But the cremazing thing was that I actually now today, like, I'm in a relationship with someone that I have never cheated on and have never wanted to cheat on.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea that that would ever be possible.
Right. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because we have emotional intimacy. Like, I've learned that was a big trigger for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like, being in a relationship where intimacy was withheld from me kind of drove me out to look for it in other places. Not that I was finding intimacy in those places,
but
like it, I guess.
Yeah.
And so, like, I work really hard to keep that connection with my partner so that my needs are being met. And when they're being met, I don't even feel triggered to go do those things,
That's
you know?
That's so interesting. I wonder how common that is among the people who are cheating.
Yeah, I don't know. It never, for me, like, cheating, the funny thing is that it never occurred to me, and this is, like, a thing, like, before you get sober, like, a lot of times,
that you're
you don't really have
else.
Values.
Right,
like,
right.
I didn't have any values. I didn't have any boundaries.
Right.
I didn't have any, it never occurred to me not to cheat on someone.
Right, right, right.
Like, you know, like, that's, like, a thing that people just know, like, oh, you don't do that. I didn't even think twice about it. I never thought, oh, I probably shouldn't cheat on my boyfriend. I just took whatever I wanted in a given moment that might make me feel good.
Right, right. I certainly really, I cheated on almost every boyfriend before I got sober.
Yeah.
And sort of. And yeah, it just didn't cross my mind that that wasn't my right.
Yeah, I didn't even think about it.
Yeah.
I had no boundaries. I mean, it's like sex for money too. Like, I didn't, that was like crossing the street for me.
Right.
You know? Like, for some, most people, that's like a thick, hard line.
Yeah.
It's a decision,
line
you know?
Yeah.
Like, for me, that was just like, oh, I'll just meander over here.
And like, ring that doorbell.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea how many times?
Oh, hundreds.
Yeah.
I mean, I did it on and off for years.
Yeah.
I've actually have not really said that publicly. So
okay.
I kind of just came out as a former sex worker.
Well, it's interesting because I was like, can I ask this? And I'm like, yes, it's Emily. I can. So you are now how long sober off drugs and alcohol?
7.5 years.
Oh, so now we know when we met.
Yeah, 7.5 years ago.
Yeah. It's passed in a second. And in that time, you went on to – well, I remember you were working at a site where you did a story on me called like Hot Woman, Hot Job or something like that.
Oh, yeah. That was when I worked at a men's site.
It was a men's site that was kind of like
Is that a little sexist? Probably is, right?
Oh, hot.
Yeah.
Well,
I was probably a little sexist back then.
I was anything that is feeds my ego.
Yeah.
I could care less. I had blood taken and the nurse is like, God, you have such strong veins.
Ooh.
And I was like,
you know what I like?
Yeah.
I like when you get a massage and they're like, you're so tense.
Oh.
That makes me feel like, yeah, I just work so hard. I'm like, I'm more tense than the average person.
You know what's interesting? I feel terribly concerned when that happens.
Oh, I feel like weirdly accomplished.
See, because my thing is that I fear and know I'm a workaholic.
Yeah.
And so, but it reinforces that there's something wrong with me for
working
so much.
Oh, for me, I just want to be like, it's still the most, you know, like whether it's good or bad, I'm still like, I'm different.
See, but what I think in recovery, I want that less.
I guess I'm still sick.
Yeah, that's kind of my point, I think. No, and so can we talk about like how your career really took off? And
well, yeah, I mean this is kind of the thing of the highs and lows of sobriety. It's like, right. I think you get sober and if things start to go really well,
yeah.
I mean, in some ways sobriety obviously just makes things a lot better.
Yes.
Because you're not hungover. And
you're operating with all your faculties.
Yes. And you know, all those little moments when I was able to show up for something, like even just the tiny little ones where like I wasn't hungover that morning or I wasn't out drinking and I worked on this thing instead or I took that call, you know,
right.
or whatever. All those little things started to really add up to a big change in my life. And
yeah.
Yeah, things got really good for me. And yeah, I got my dream job.
By the way, I will inject here that at the reunion for that group or whatever, you said to me, I got this job offer. And then I also got this offer to do like some video, to produce videos. Which should I do? You called me.
I don't remember that. I do remember calling you for advice.
And I took such credit. I was like, Emily McCombs would not have that job if I hadn't told her to take it.
Well, I was scared because it was...
a startup, right?
Yeah. And it was not that much money. And it ended up being more money,
yeah.
you know, because it worked out.
Yeah.
But it was risky, but...
But not. It was so obvious that was going to be a
Yeah. And, a you know, thing. The funny thing was I had a job. I had gotten a job.
Yeah.
And I had been there for 2 weeks.
Yes. It was like a video
and
producing videos or something.
And then I got this other offer. And, of course, it was what I wanted to do. But I felt horrible that I had to quit this job after 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah. I was like, don't worry about it.
It was like friends, you know. It was like friends who helped me. Like,
I was like,
oh,
don't worry
job.
About
like-
it. Yeah. Just do what you need to do.
Anyway, it all worked out. And I, you know, my career, like, and before, like with career stuff, I had been like very resentful and jealous of people who were doing well in their careers. You know, I was just angry and drunk and like, I was working in educational publishing and I was commenting on Gawker all day.
I didn't know that.
Meanly commenting on Gawker all day.
But lots of people some people get jobs from that.
Well, I did. I was a very popular Gawker commenter in my day.
Right, right. Good.
I don't know if it's really like that anymore. But
Richard
there was
Lawson's
a time,
career was launched.
He was
by
one
then.
Of my friends at the, like, that was the, that was when it was happening. That was when I was a Gawker commenter. He was one of my, like, commenter friends.
Right.
Yeah. So, but in retrospect, like, just a nasty, like, person, just,
to
like,
go on the nastiest
shitting on people.
Site in the world.
And just looking for, I mean, you're just trying to impress the other commenters, so you're just looking for whatever mean joke you can make on a given post that's going to be, it's not even about the post, it's just, okay, where's the mean joke so I can impress everybody, you know?
Well, which is, happened a lot on XO Jane, right?
It does, yeah, which is funny, because it's so the exact opposite of who I am now, and, yeah, I dealt with that a lot. On XO Jane and other places on the internet, like people just tearing me down personally.
right. And didn't that change? I know when I started to get really mean comments, I sort of made this decision. I'm never going to tweet something that's obnoxious. Like I just, I get that people see that stuff and it's hurtful.
Yeah. I mean, I have some trolls who literally just
wait for you to
just
post
live
stuff.
To harass me, and they create new accounts. I block them, and the accounts will be like Captain Rapist, you know?
Jesus. Like,
and when it really got hard was when people started to target my child.
Oh,
and that
God.
Was when I locked down a lot of my social media, which is like not good for my career
right.
as an online writer and editor right. and personality. But, you know, basically someone called him the N-word
oh,
on a picture
God.
On Instagram. And that was just like, okay, like shut it all down, burn it down, like
right.
forget
right.
this. Anyway, but like, so I had been really, I was really bitter and resentful that other people had successful careers, although I was doing nothing to
yes,
get a
advancers.
Successful career.
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, I was writing, but
yeah.
yeah, I was a drunk, you know?
Yeah.
And so, you know, then when I sort of like, when I actually became happy with myself
right.
and started to work on my shit, that's when, you know, of course, the career stuff started to happen for me.
I don't know about you. I mean, a huge thing for me, I had a very similar thing when I got sober. All I did was get fired before I got sober.
Yeah.
And then suddenly in my first like 5 years, got all the dreams
yeah,
I wanted.
And it feels like a reward for being sober, right? Like,
which is why I'm so impressed with people who get sober and like supposedly things all fall apart.
But that's what started to happen
I
after,
know.
You know, that's what's
I
happening
know.
To me now. It's
right.
like, so there's this weird, like the correlation that you make in your head is like, I got sober and now I've got this amazing career
right,
and
right.
I got, you know, I got engaged, I got
right.
a child,
right.
You know, I adopted a child. I just said, explain that because got a child sounds pretty weird.
But you,
if you don't know what that
you
means.
Were fostering.
We became a foster parent with my fiance at the time, you know, and it was like, I've got everything because I'm sober.
Right, right,
and
right.
And then I lost it all.
Not the child.
Well, I lost the relationship.
And got a new
I have
one.
The child. I have joint custody of the child. But of course, that was a painful,
right.
you know, horrible experience
right.
For him and for me.
Yeah.
And then the site that I was working for was sold to a huge media company. And I got just cut out of the deal, basically.
Yeah.
We couldn't come to an agreement
mm-hmm,
on
mm-hmm.
sort of what I was worth and mm-hmm.
what they could afford.
And, you know, and this was something that I created. I had launched. I had been there since the beginning. It had
yep.
been my baby. I had created it, you know, with other people. But
you were to me, I assume to many people, the central figure, but whatever.
Well, thanks. You're
yeah.
my friend.
But, well,
but it had been my baby and it had
yeah.
been my life and a lot of my identity. And what I've also discovered since that is that I had a pretty cherry situation in the sense of like pretty much complete creative freedom, pretty much being the boss, not really having to answer to anyone, just sort of doing what I wanted all the time.
And I don't know about you, but this is what happened to me by getting a lot of those gifts in sobriety is it didn't occur to me that I was lucky. It just occurred to me that I was very deserving.
I was very wonderful.
And that I just my wonderfulness had been discovered because of my sobriety.
Same.
And that it would only continue.
Yeah, same. No, it was all on the upswing from there.
Yep.
And then so then when I sort of lost all of that stuff, you know, at first it's like maybe this is just a temporary setback,
right? But it is,
but it's a temporary setback that's been going
continued
on
longer
for
than you'd like
a
yeah.
few years now
right.
of just like bad things happening,
right?
So yeah, there's that, there's the realization, like you're saying, that oh no, it's, you don't just get good things because you're sober. Like good things and bad things happen when you're sober, and it's nice that I had
yes.
nice things happened to me
right.
in the first few years of my sobriety.
Right.
But it wasn't actually like a reward from God for my sobriety.
Right. But maybe the reward is to get you to appreciate it very much when it comes back.
Well, it's true. And the reward is also that when you are in a place like this where you're really lost, you're really bottomed out, like you don't know where you're going or what's going to happen, that you have a way to deal with it.
Yep.
Because I don't know what people do when this happens and you're not sober and you don't have a program, because
but only bad things happened to me before I was sober and didn't have a program.
But I mean just regular people, like
right.
not even like
yeah.
like just regular people who aren't alcoholics.
Right.
Like everybody has phases
bad stuff
like
happens.
This,
yeah.
you know, a couple of years where somebody dies and you lose your job and then
right.
somebody else has cancer and you're, you know, just horrible things that you have to deal with in life. Now I get to sort of say to myself, like, pain is the touchstone of spiritual growth. Yeah. And I get to like turn it over,
yeah,
you know, and I get to like trust the universe and my higher power.
Right.
And I have a support group built in recovery, you know.
You have a place where you can go.
I have a place I can just go and get talk sort about of
free
it
therapy.
And get hugged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And rewarded and thanked.
Yeah. And like, and so what do you do if you don't have that?
I know. Does this? It's been occurring to me that like all of humanity that I had so little respect for, that we're all so impressive. Like even these people I have zero respect for various reasons, survive insurmountable things.
Yeah.
Guaranteed, everybody is going to have like their parents die. Everybody is going to have certain terrible things happen to them. And they just do it.
Right. And then the other thing I try to do is remember all the stuff that's not terrible because, I don't, you know, you don't have a job or your career falls apart and your relationship falls apart. But I have a healthy child. I'm healthy. You know, things could always be worse.
Yes. Yes. It's true. So, okay. And so what else about addiction or recovery do you think it's important to impart to people who are struggling or, you know, to get sober or sober and struggling?
I mean, for me, like before I got sober, I think the biggest thing that held me back from getting sober, other than that, I just didn't have that, whatever that willingness was that just was given to me at some point. I didn't think life was going to be fun anymore.
Yeah.
And that has not proven itself to be true at all. And in fact, I would say I have a lot more fun now than I did. And I discovered so many things that I thought were fun that I actually didn't even like once I wasn't drinking.
Like parties with drunk people.
Or like concerts, you know, like not every concert, but like things that I would have gone to just because I knew I could get drunk there.
Right.
Like once the alcohol was gone, it was like, I don't want to be here.
And certain people,
this
probably
isn't fun. Yeah, yeah. Certain people. Oh, definitely certain people.
Yeah.
Where all of a sudden you're having your first sober conversation with someone and you realize you hate them.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that you have nothing in common with them and they were your best friend.
Yeah. Well, I had all these friends that I didn't even know their last names. I had all the bar friends, you know, like I had people in my phone just as like Metallica, you know, or like like Vadim Cocaine, you know, like I didn't know what people did for a living or we never saw each other in daylight.
Well, a lot of those people didn't do anything for a living in my experience.
Oh, I just don't know. I didn't bother to ask.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's different with the Coke crew because you have this Coke crew that like you all just kind of – you talk endlessly about all the things that you're going to do.
Yeah. Well, and about all your childhood trauma.
You do talk a lot about that.
I talked a lot about rape when I was
– Well, I remember like somebody like passing me the mirror and then like passing me the book, the trauma of the gifted child or some book about the gifted child.
Oh, no.
And toxic parents and books like that, you know. But I did want to actually touch on that story about my rapist contacted me on Facebook. Was that like the big thing that got – I mean, that got a lot of attention.
That was literally the first thing I wrote for XO Jane.
Yeah.
And it was the first thing that went up from me. And it was funny because it was something that I had pitched to other like women's magazines like Marie Claire and like, you know, Glamour, Elle, like those kinds of magazines. I don't remember which ones I actually pitched it to. And nobody would touch it.
Yeah.
And then I brought it. I started working with Jane and I was like, I have this, like, I talked to my rapist and like, I kind of want to publish like an interview with my rapist. And she was like, yes, you know, right. Like so into it. And then, yeah, it made it. There have been more stories like that now that it's a bigger thing now with social media being such a part of people's lives. Of course, these like unpleasant people pop up, you know?
Yeah.
But it was kind of the first story, I think, that really hit that topic. And I went on Dr. Phil and I went on NPR and like got read horrible comments about myself all over the internet.
Did you talk to the rapist after all the sensation?
I never talked to him again. I'm sure he saw it.
Yeah.
That was like my biggest fear was that he was going to reach out to me afterward and be angry. I think, you know, I think he genuinely felt very remorseful and very upset at how much what had happened to me had gone on to affect me. Because to him, it wasn't as like, you know, he was also a teenager. And to him, I don't think he realized what had really happened or what a big deal it was. So yeah, he actually felt bad. And so I think that when it started getting attention, he probably continued to feel bad and just sort of slunk away.
Yeah.
And I think he deleted his social media. I mean, I didn't ever reveal his name or anything like that. But when I went on Dr. Phil, the funny thing was, well, not really funny, the horrifying thing was, so I'm in the green room and they make you sign this form right before you go on, you know, like just releasing them from whatever. And in there, it says specifically like, we can bring anyone from your past, anyone, blah, 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 this and that. So I got terrified that he was there.
Right.
And they had producers in there like talking me down. Because I was like, I'm not signing this. I'm not going out. Like, is he here? You know? And so they got producers down there to tell me like, he's not here. But that was like, that was the nightmare. And then, and with Dr. Phil, is just like, I didn't know, because he's kind of known for the tough love thing. Like, I didn't know how he was going to treat me, but he was great.
Yeah.
And he asked me, he let me get my message out there exactly, which was, you know, he said to me, like, what would you say to a 14-year-old girl who's going through, like, what you were going through right now? So I got to say, like, it's not your fault, no matter what. Doesn't matter if you were drunk or if you liked the guy or if you blah, blah, you know, I got to get that out. So that was great. And the other memorable thing from that was I got flown to L.A. to do it. And my best friend Taylor lives in LA, and he came with me like for moral support. And the hotel I was staying at, you know, the show gave us like a voucher for the restaurant there. And we went to eat at the restaurant, and my friend, and this in the gallows humor kind of like sense that we have, like my friend Taylor was just like, thank you so much for getting raped so we could have this delicious meal.
Oh my God. So,
so it was all worth it.
It was totally worth it.
I think I had a steak.
A free meal at some hotel, some not
hotel restaurant.
Hotel.
Yeah.
And did you read the Stanford rape victim letter?
I did. Yeah. I wrote something about it for Ravishly.
Okay.
Yeah. About the 20 minutes, you know, what the 20 minutes of action that his dad said in the article, just sort of like what the actual like trauma impact of 20 minutes is on a victim.
Right. Or 2 minutes or 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Exactly. Yeah. That the just how profoundly trauma changes your mind and body and emotions and how it follows you for the rest of your life, and how here I am 33, like still having to deal with this shit, you know, like it's so unfair.
It's so unfair.
I say that all the time, and my therapist is just like, you're right, it's very unfair. And I'm like, but it's unfair.
My first sentence was, it's not fair.
But you have to just accept it. I mean, you're like, it's not fair, but this is what I've been given.
Yeah.
And I have to deal with
it. For reasons I can't explain.
Yeah, that are not fair, that are not right.
Yeah.
You know, and the person who hurt me and made me this way is out there probably feeling fine.
Right.
You know,
possibly hurting other people.
And I had spent a decade in therapy, you know, like trying to work through the fact that a bunch of guys decided to rape me one night, you know, when I was 14.
One could argue that the people who did that were never feeling fine.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I just think that I think there's so little understanding about consent with men, like, especially like I'm from Oklahoma. These were teenage boys. They were a little bit older than me, but they were still teenagers.
Right.
And this group thing, too, like that's still happening. That's still a big issue of like the Steubenville thing, like this, a group of guys at a party deciding to, you know, rape a girl. Now they put the pictures on social media, you know, I'm lucky that didn't exist yet.
Right.
But it's like there's some weird mentality there. Like there was one guy who was kind of the ringleader. And I think, something was not okay with him.
Yeah.
These other guys, I don't know if they fully understood what they were doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Not that makes it right or okay, but I think there just needs to be better education. You know, I tried really work on that with my own son. That his body is his body. And if he doesn't want to kiss or he doesn't want to hug or he doesn't want to be tickled, you know, I stop immediately.
Yeah.
And then hopefully that translates to him. Like everyone's body is their own body. And if someone says, don't touch my body, stop. No, you immediately stop. You know, even if you're playing, you're tickling, you're poking somebody, you know, it's sort of starting that now.
Yeah.
Like body autonomy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's a good message to close on.
Let's just close on body autonomy.
Well, body autonomy, and you know how those lines get very, very blurred when you're, you know, stir substances into the mix.
They absolutely do. It's one reason I go to women's meetings.
Oh, you only do now?
Mostly. I mean, just because I need to talk about that stuff that happens to women when we drink.
And I do think it's definitely as the Craigslist culture, you know, that wasn't a thing when I got sober. I got sober in
You're like old lady sober.
Please.
Old lady sober.
I'm going to have 16 years if you don't think that makes me feel old every day.
You're not
day.
Old, but...
You know, it is called an old timer. So there's
that's
that.
That's true. I don't know if you're quite an old timer.
No,
yet.
I think 20.
I think you have to hit 20. Yeah.
I mean, I'm going to, God willing. So
let's hope.
There's that. Okay. Well, all right. So that was Emily McCombs on After Party Pod. After Party Pod is a part of After Party Magazine, which is a part of Rehab Reviews, which is a part of The World. If you want to subscribe to the newsletter, go to afterpartynewsletter.com. We will send you the ebook, How I Got Sober, 10 Writers Share Their Stories. If you want to reach me, Anna, at the After Party Group, goodbye.